Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. This week, we're going to take another look at the escalating conflict in Crimea and what it means for the rest of Eastern Europe. If you're unfamiliar, in late 2013, pro-European protesters in Ukraine began demonstrating against their government's decision to break off accession talks with the European Union. A revolution ousted the pro-Russian government, and Russia retaliated by sending forces into the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea. Crimeans voted to join Russia in March after a highly questionable referendum took place. Today, Russian forces continue to mass at the eastern border with Ukraine, and the international community wonders what will happen next. Joining us today on Global Journalist, Steve Herman, Voice of America's Southeast Asia Bureau Chief, who was in Ukraine last month, and Vytis Jurkonis, who is the Project Director of Freedom House based in Vilnius, Lithuania. And thank you to you both for joining us today on Global Journalist. Steve Herman, maybe we can begin with you and talk a little bit about these recent events, because it seems hour by hour as things continue to change in Ukraine. Bring us up to date.
Well, there have been some fairly recent developments. Vladimir Putin has sent a letter from Moscow to European leaders, and he's warning that Russia could cut the gas supplies to Ukraine if the Ukrainian government doesn't pay its bills after a switch to advance statements or advance payments. So a bit of severe economic pressure being directed directly from the Russian president at this point. Meanwhile, the NATO General Secretary was again calling for Russia to pull back its troops from the Ukrainian border. He says there's about 40,000 massed along the border. Now, Russia, of course, has claimed that they were there for training exercises. No one in the West is buying into that, and the intelligence that has been leaked is pointing to even mobile hospitals being set up, which you normally would not do for an exercise unless it's an extremely realistic exercise. Now, there's still a hope that diplomacy will cool things off. What we have, even the NATO General Secretary and U.S. military officials and U.S. government officials saying, is that if Russia moves into eastern Ukraine, that there will be more severe economic sanctions. No one's talking about NATO troops or foreign troops going into Ukraine. The United States has committed to sending in MREs. That's not any fancy weapon. Those are meals ready to eat. So and essentially, that's the only immediate military support that Ukraine is getting from the United States. And of course, no one expects that the Ukrainian military in its present size and shape would be able to halt a Russian invasion. But of course, if the Russians go in there, they would need a tremendous amount of troops to occupy eastern Ukraine. And many military analysts are skeptical that the Russians want to start sending young men back in body bags to Russia, because it would bring up images of what the Russians had to deal with in Afghanistan. There would definitely be a guerrilla warfare backlash by Ukrainians if the Russians do try to occupy eastern Ukraine.
Complicating factors just a bit, Steve, is the situation in Donetsk and certainly other eastern cities where pro-Russian populations have basically occupied in Donetsk at least one key government building. Depending on who you listen to, that is either being characterized as a very small and ineffective movement that is more symbolic. But of course, against the backdrop of what has happened in Crimea, no one's taking it all that lightly either.
Certainly, that does not appear to be generating mass support, but we know throughout eastern Ukraine that there is either covert or overt support from Russian agencies, whether they're the military intelligence agencies or other groups that are trying to stir up trouble in that part of the country. And as you mentioned, maybe perhaps trying to replicate a Crimean situation.
Vytis Jurkonis, give us a little bit of perspective from Lithuania. Some of these sort of meanderings are certainly not anything new to anyone who has a history of being a part of the Eastern Bloc, do they?
Well, yes, indeed. Lithuania was very enthusiastic about the association agreement with Ukraine. Let me remind you that Lithuania was at the presidency of the EU last year, and they had big expectations about Ukraine signing the association agreement. But the developments now in Ukraine are really shocking, and the reaction of the population is really a mix. The majority, of course, is appalled. There has been a lot of solidarity actions with Ukraine. Some are surprised, mostly those who were the fans of the reset policy with Russia. Some are afraid because, well, we have Kaliningrad nearby. We have Belarus close to our borders, and there have been some military trainings which were perceived as a threat to Lithuanian national security. There's also part of the population which is either like nostalgic about the Soviet Union or are too much influenced by the Russian media, Russian propaganda, so they would be more or less supportive to the Kremlin's intervention to Crimea. So it's really a mix, but the general attitude is that it's shocking and it's unprecedented. We have considered this part of Europe, like Eastern Europe, to be relatively safe, talking about the hard security issues. Of course, there were a lot of human rights concerns and things like that, but nobody thought that it might happen, like Kremlin intervening the neighboring country. There was a signal, though, in Georgia in 2008, and I think that back then the West and the international community responded too softly, and actually all the agreements with Russia were never implemented by the Russian authorities. They didn't pull their troops out, and I don't think they are going to pull the troops out from Crimea either.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today we're taking another look at the conflict in Crimea and the wider geopolitical implications of it. Joining us today, Steve Herman, Voice of America's Southeast Asia Bureau Chief, who was in Ukraine last month, and Vytis Jurkonis, who is the Project Director of Freedom House based in Vilnius. And Vytis, you know, when we talk about these sort of regions of frozen conflict, there is precedent in places like Transnistria where there is a pocket of basically an entire strip of land that is basically being occupied by Russian forces, and yet it stands on the western edge of what is present Ukraine. And so explain how that can happen in countries that are, frankly, not a part of the old Soviet Union any longer.
Well, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there are at least couple of regions which are called frozen conflicts. So one of them, like Abkhazian Ossetia, became hot conflict in 2008. And Crimea actually was never ever considered to be like a frozen conflict, but it had a huge presence of the Russian speaking population. So it became a hot conflict as well. Transnistria is one of the frozen conflicts, and it is heavily controlled by the Russian influence. So it might be the next step, especially if Moldova pursues the Euro way, and signs the association agreement with Europe. The situation might escalate there as well. And we have also Nagorno-Karabakh, where the conflict parties are Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Russia. And potentially it could also escalate at some point. But neither Azerbaijan nor Armenia, they are not looking forward to deepening their relationship with Europe. So I think the next region of concern should be Transnistria.
One other point on that. There are many Russian-speaking people who believe that Kiev is in some respects more the cultural, has more cultural roots for Russians than, say, Moscow. Can you explain that, Vitas?
Well, I would argue with that because the Ukrainian media is largely written in the Russian language, and the Kremlin has been playing this coin of as if there is some Ukrainian nationalism. It's really not true. It's over-exaggerated, and I have friends even in the eastern part of Ukraine, and they were neither threatened by Ukrainians. On the contrary, they feel threatened by the Russian authorities, Russian provocations, and well, even the recent pollings before the Crimean annexation was that January, it showed that the majority of the population wants to see, to be in Ukraine, in independent Ukraine, and they don't want to be part of Russia, not ever.
Well, I think one thing that is valid to point out for those who are more casual observers and go in there and trying to differentiate between the two civilizations, because in a sense the modern peoples of Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia all claim this Kievan Rus as the roots of their civilization. And religiously, there's the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church, but a lot of the Ukrainians go to the Russian Orthodox Church, which pays homage to the Moscow Patriarchy. And then, as has been pointed out, you can use, except for maybe Western Ukraine, you can certainly use Russian language throughout Ukraine. So, and I met a lot of older men who, of course, served in the Red Army, and felt a very strong bond with the Soviet Union and Russia, and lamented that brothers might be having to fight against brothers soon. And a point in case, what we saw with the Marines in Ukraine, Ukrainian Marines, who should be the most elite of the Ukrainian forces, based on all estimations, more than half of them went over to the Russian forces when given a choice, because they had families in Crimea and they knew that was their only choice to keep the families together. It's a very sad situation. We talk about a civil war between in Ukraine itself, but it's almost as if we have a civil war of a culture between Ukraine and Russia existing at this point.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today we're taking another look at the conflict in Crimea and the wider geopolitical implications in it. We're joined today by Steve Herman, Voice of America's Southeast Asia Bureau Chief, who was in the Ukraine last month, and Vitas Yurkonis, who's the Project Director of Freedom House based in Vilnius. And I want to remind you that you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website, globaljournalist.org. You can also find links to other stories related to this broadcast, including interviews with journalists in the region. For more Global Journalist content, you can also like us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. And Steve, because you were on the ground, you've been able to sort of witness the difference in media coverage. And this is fascinating because Ukraine is trying to limit the amount of Russian coverage in the country within its borders because there are two very different messages coming out of that reporting.
Yes. Well, when I was there, the Russian media, as far as the television channels, were still pretty pervasive, and a lot of people watch it. And, of course, it is very propagandistic. It is definitely not a fair and free press coming from Russia. Ukrainian media has had its own issues. Of course, there's been a lot of political change happening very quickly in Ukraine, but we had a clash where some right-wingers went into a TV station in Kiev and beat up one of the managers because they thought his coverage was too objective. And I think that among the Ukrainians themselves, there's just been so much that's been happening so quickly. People in Maidan, in the square in central Kiev, were still reeling from, you know, their own forces assassinating their young demonstrators. Of course, there's also allegations that some of these snipers were brought in from Russia. There does seem to be some evidence of that. And then to have this happen when they're demoralized and weakened in trying to get their own new government up and running, to have the Russians come in and basically take over a critical a province like Crimea. And now what's happening in the eastern part of the country, it's almost happening too quickly for the new interim government and the military to respond adequately to it. They just and it's obvious that Putin and Russia are definitely taking advantage of this situation with Ukraine being so weak and unstable right now.
And yet, Vitas Yurkonis, there is an election looming in just more than or about 30 days from now. What can the government do, aside from perhaps returning some local control to some of these regions, which carries with it its own set of issues, to sort of unify the country and perhaps to bring some sense of stability to this situation?
Well, it's an extremely difficult task, knowing that this new government is really new. It was even called the suicide government, right, by the prime minister himself. So we have to understand what is happening in the eastern Ukraine. We are talking about some staged situation, like provocations by Russian tourists. So one thing, like agents, tourists, like criminal people. So first of all, the Ukraine should deal with its borders, because unless they control the borders, these provocators are going to be present in the eastern Ukraine, staging some provocations, occupation of the administrations and things like that. So without that, I don't think, without the control of the borders, I don't think it's possible actually to get rid of the situation like we have now in eastern Ukraine. And if the intervention still continues, so I don't think that we can have the free and fair election there, at least not in the eastern Ukraine. And therefore, that's the main primary target, because currently I don't think that the the government is able to control the situation fully. It's basically dealing with the crisis management. They are not doing anything when it comes to the reforms, which are very much needed for the economy, for the society. And that's what Russia is trying to do, to jeopardize any developments and reforms in the country.
And that definitely does appear to play into their hands. The longer there is instability in Ukraine as a whole, it seems the more the hands of the present interim government are tied. Certainly, if the election is delayed, at least many prognosticators believe that will only deepen and worsen this situation. Do you see it that way, Vytis?
Well, sure. We are talking about the attempt to paralyze Ukraine, to paralyze the government, and then, like, in the long term, that would discredit the authorities, the current authorities, and the population would be frustrated, even the one which was at the Maidan, which were, in favor of Ukraine going the European way. But if the government is that weak, so I think that there's no other way than just to have this instability, and therefore the government need to show some firm steps.
Steve Herman, Vytis mentioned this just a little bit earlier, but the U.S. and the EU and NATO response, has it been appropriate for the situation? Should it have been greater at some point heretofore?
Well, I think NATO legally is very limited as to what it can actually do in Ukraine. And the United States, I just don't think it's conceivable at this stage that there would be any demonstration of U.S. forces in the country. The talk, as I said, is all about further severe economic sanctions should Russia do anything more. I don't think either side at this point wants to be accused of being the instigator of a new Cold War. Although you hear language referencing that coming out of from both sides now, from NATO headquarters, from Washington, and from Moscow, and it seems like we're pretty close to that. Also, there was just a warning from Moscow that if NATO troops are to go on the borders of countries now bordering Russia, that would be that would be illegal, and so how the question is with each step, how does the other side respond to it? I think there's been in Western Europe and in Washington an attempt to try to manage the situation, not to have some move taken by the West give Moscow some sort of excuse to ratchet things up further. There's still a hope with this upcoming four-way meeting that diplomacy might be able to move things back from the brink. But there's also a lot of pessimism. The other thing that I do see is on other issues, they are trying to keep things separate, such as the negotiations going on and the talks involving Iran's nuclear program or Syria. There's still an attempt by, I think, both Moscow and Washington to keep other things separate from now, because if we went into a new quote-unquote Cold War, then we could see severe ramifications for these discussions that have been going on involving the United States and Russia about Iran and Syria. And I don't think anybody wants to go in that direction.
To the issue of what the central government in Kiev can do to perhaps create or ease the situation, particularly in the eastern parts of the country, Steve, having been there in the last 30 or 45 days, I'm sure you probably had some discussions with some folks about what that might do, even though you were in the central part of the country. Do you get a sense of that? You want to take a crack at that?
Well, I think, as Vytis pointed out, just how successful of an election you can have in the eastern part of the country is going to be absolutely critical. Moscow does not recognize the interim government in Kiev. It believes that this was the result of a coup, as it puts it. And if there are substantial issues with the election in the eastern part of the country, that gives Moscow, in its eyes, further justification to possibly move in. And then you have groups in eastern Ukraine that want to hold these referendums similar to the Crimea referendums. So I think any objective observer is going to be a little bit pessimistic about a very smooth outcome for things in eastern Ukraine over the next 30 to 60 days.
And Vytis, what about the repercussions beyond Ukraine in places like Lithuania?
Well, we see the bigger NATO presence in the region. It should be increasing. So really, these hard security issues are going back to the agenda. I think that, on the other hand, the events in Ukraine served as the eye-opener for some of the Western capitals, and it is important to understand that the Kremlin is far from the good neighbor and the friendly neighbor. So I think the major challenge now for Europe, and I think for Lithuania, Poland, the Czech Republic, is to think, what about the Eastern Partnership Initiative? In Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belarus, they are not willing to participate due to many reasons, like the pressure from Kremlin, including Ukraine is in chaos, it's not stable. So we have Georgia and Moldova as potentially the success cases, but we need to reform and to reconsider our strategy with the eastern neighborhood, because it's really, really an increasingly worrying situation. And we need to deal with that because, well, for Lithuania, it has the longest border with Belarus. So you know, some provocations like in Crimea might be taking place as well. So we don't want that for sure.
Steve Herman, with just less than a minute left in the show, what comes next? Are you optimistic about these four-way talks next week and whether or not there is something that happens?
Not very optimistic. Hopeful, yes, but not very optimistic. The rhetoric day by day is deteriorating. So can that meeting pull things back? We will have to see whether some extraordinary diplomats can engage in some extraordinary diplomacy.
That will have to be the final word. That's all for this edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us on the program were Steve Herman, Voice of America's Southeast Asia Bureau Chief, who was in Ukraine last month, and Vytis Jurkonis, the Project Director of Freedom House, based in Vilnius, Lithuania. Our executive producer is Casey Morrell. Our lead producer, Victoria Makute. Pat Akers from KBIA is our audio engineer. Join us again next time for another edition of Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink.